This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. So it's right in the middle of summer, so things are moving along very nicely as far as sun shines out. It's kind of warm outside. Yep. I like it. I'm not a fan of the cold, but I guess I'll get over it eventually.
God, your mind's just wandering around. Go ahead. Let's stick
yeah,
to the business.
Yeah, it is. All right. So our questions today we're going to be talking about the relationship between money and self-esteem, talking about casual mating strategy but whether or not casual mating is a good idea in amongst friends in a social circle. And the other questions about why people make things up. specifically on television when asked questions. And then the last question is about how distance affects relationships, whether with friends or mates. So let's just get to it. Dr. Lyle, I grew up in a poor household. My mother was abusive both physically and mentally and taught me that I was wasteful if I bought nice things and clothes, etc. Now I'm 43 years old. My husband is nice, generous, and makes a lot of money, but I still feel wasteful and not worth it when I want to buy me an expensive handbag. It's like my mind is stuck in my poor childhood and has not moved on to my new, richer life. Can you please talk about the relationship between money and self-esteem and how to learn to enjoy the money one makes?
Well, let's think about this. A major component that we're actually seeing here that our listener isn't seeing is that her mother, not necessarily out of necessity, but also by instinct, was frugal. And so she was probably more dramatically frugal by necessity. But there's a lot of poor people that are not frugal and might buy an expensive handbag and then cause them to be to have other hardships later as a result of that, like not getting the rent paid. So the fact that the mother was her mother was abusive both mentally and physically, of course, tells us that the mother was disagreeable and unstable. But she was also probably frugal. And so our listener inherited frugal genes. And so that's a lot of what you're seeing here. So even though she is in better circumstances, she still cannot, open up her wallet and pay for things that look attractive to her but are not attractive enough to get her to dole out the money. Now, you might think that this is a reach, but of course it's not a reach. This is exactly what the great Professor Plowman would expect. Okay, once again, environmental influences are going to sum to zero over time. So she's 43 years old, and what we're seeing is the genes. We're not seeing the effect of a childhood. In fact, in a rather famous book written, I believe, in the early 90s, or might have been the late 80s or so, is called The Millionaire Next Door. And what they found surprised the authors, which was that the America's millionaires at the time, that was more money than it is now, because the inflation rate, if you have $1 million now, that was worth about $400,000 in 1992. So now it would be the equivalent of $2 million or $2.5 million, something like that. So America's millionaires are typically very frugal, particularly if they've earned it themselves, as opposed to having it given to them by inheritance. That makes a big difference in how frugal they are. And one of the most striking characteristics is that it didn't make any difference how big the net worth was. They also studied what they considered very high net worth people, people with net worths at the time of $10 million and north. And they would find that a consistent characteristic is that the men would complain that their wives would not spend any money. It just wasn't in them. And they're still clipping coupons and doing everything possible to keep the budget down. So a big part of the capital accumulation of a lot of well-to-do people has to do with obviously the personalities, of course, their talent and skill and luck and effort, but also their personalities with respect to expenditure is a major issue. And so the I think that our listener here has a very frugal personality, and we're seeing that, you know, continue on in her life, even though she would feel like she ought to loosen the reins a little bit, which of course it wouldn't kill you to try to loosen the reins to see what happens. But the truth is that if you loosen the reins and buy an expensive handbag, you may look at that thing and it may not give you that much joy, because you'll just feel vaguely guilty and self-indulgent about it, like it was a waste of money. And that isn't from your childhood, that's from your genetics. So anyway, that's the story. And she also wanted to know about the relationship between money and self-esteem. Also, a little side note is that it's her husband that makes the money, not her. And so as a result, it wouldn't surprise me any if there's an effect here in the system that the person themselves does not necessarily feel competent to actually earn a high standard of living. And so as a result of that, it doesn't feel like this whole thing is under her control. It feels like it's graft that she is receiving as part of this relationship, which, of course, there's nothing in the world wrong with this, except that it feels different spending somebody else's money that they earned versus spending it, blowing your money on yourself when you have, in fact, you've in fact earned it and have confidence that you could earn it again. So that's a different situation, and it's one that she's not in. So we can't observe what happen under those circumstances. So she's probably still feeling a significant degree of responsibility to this relationship, to not be, to just despite what the husband says, there's still a feeling of, it's not quite mine. I didn't quite earn it. I couldn't replace it. And therefore, it would be irresponsible of me to waste it. It's not that wise of an option. So this person may not be that open to experience, maybe quite high conscientiousness. And as a result, not feeling like, you know, it's not an adventure worth doing, and it doesn't feel safe and right. She might feel differently if she earned it herself, and then you know, did the CB on some, you know, indulgent expenditure. So I think that's what's going on there. Now, the relationship between money and self-esteem, there really isn't a relationship between money and self-esteem as I define self-esteem. Now, I'm defining self-esteem differently than the broad culture defines self-esteem. So I'm trying to be very precise so that we can learn and think intelligently about the dynamics of what goes on in our minds, you know, free of confusion about what the different experiences are. So there are multiple experiences that people might term self-esteem. And And yet they are quite different in terms of what drives those experiences. One of them is going to be what we're going to call esteem or status. So that's when other people signal to us that they think that we are valuable, i.e. cool, sexy, smart, funny, whatever, okay, talented. In whatever way it is that we are competing with displays with our competitors with respect to any life domain, whether it be mating, friendship, or trade, if we get signals from other people that they find us valuable, then particularly valuable at the upper reaches of our trading range, and therefore our goals, we have essentially a calibration system that tells us what kind of feedback would be valuable. So if some four-year-old looks up at LeBron James when he makes a basket shooting around and says, wow, that was really good, that's not going to mean much to LeBron James. He didn't do anything that impressive. However, if he does something as impressive as he can, and it is seen by his peers or other important people to him, and they signal that they appreciate that accomplishment or display, that is esteem. And so that's one experience. Another experience is the experience of self-confidence. So self-confidence is different than self-confidence is in many people's minds, the way they use the language, it's entirely synonymous with self-esteem. It means the same thing. Like, oh, my kid won a ribbon in school and he got this award. It's good for his self-esteem. Okay. Has nothing to do with the self-esteem from the way I use the language. Self-esteem is different than self-confidence. Self-confidence is the feeling that falls out of or is directly derived from the perceived self-efficacy or the perceived probability of success with respect to any endeavor. So I have high self-confidence that I can tie my shoes. Okay. I had a cousin who blew off his hand playing with explosives, and he only had, half a finger and a thumb left, and his self-confidence about his ability to tie his shoes dropped. And then he figured out that he could do it, and his self-confidence rose again. So your self-confidence is different than general confidence, because confidence you could have in other things, like you're confident that Amazon stock is going to go up and you're confident that the Lakers are going to win this year. But what we're specifically concerned about is self-confidence. And that is a feeling that is effectively predicting what you think the response of the esteem environment is going to be. So Brad Pitt walks into a bar and he feels a thing that we call confidence, which is that his perceived probability of success, that he's going to get high esteem signals from whoever he wants in the bar, is high. That's a feeling of confidence. Parents want their children to have that. They think that that's the most important thing in the world. The educators, teachers, coaches, everybody thinks that's what self-esteem is. Okay, it is not what self-esteem is. And you do not talk confidence into anybody. Confidence is a derivative of the perceived probability of success. There's a lot of people that have a lot of confidence that don't have any business having any confidence. That's called a narcissist, okay? And they fail repeatedly, and they don't manage to learn the lesson despite the avalanche of evidence that they're miscalibrated, but they're miscalibrated genetically. There's just no way that that's not going to happen. Most people don't have that problem. Most people are quite sensitive to negative feedback and quite sensitive to evidence about their perceived probabilities of success are reasonably accurate. Again, people magically think very often that the solution to greater success in the world is to somehow trick yourself into having higher confidence, and therefore you'll be more bold. And, as Goethe said, mighty forces will come to your aid. Not true. Okay. That's not how it works. Confidence, self-confidence is derived from deep logical algorithms that are computing probabilities of success. And they're not subject to PR. They might be subject to, they are slightly subject to PR if knowledgeable people like a Tony Robbins looks you in the eye and plays cool music and people dance and they say, we think you have star quality, it will influence your confidence. However, that confidence will quickly be dispelled after he sleeps with you, gives you a card to his agent, and then it turns out that the guy doesn't return your phone call. And after you're not quite as hot as anybody thought you were. Okay. So that's how that works. So your self-confidence is somewhat subject to PR, i.e. distortions in market feedback. But very quickly, it will arrive at a reasonable equilibrium as you run experiments on your market advertisements and you get feedback. So that's how that's going to work. Now, everybody would like to have, quote, more confidence. But the only way that you're going to get more confidence is to get actually more effective at the competitive display. And the way that you're going to do that is you're going to make efforts that your competitors aren't making, or you're going to work harder than your competitors are working. And so what's going to happen is there's an experience inside that takes place when you work hard and diligently at worthwhile goals. And that is what we call self-esteem. So self-esteem is the internal audience's observation of your efforts, and it sends a signal of moral worthiness to your esteem meter. And it says, we respect you. You're working very hard. That's how that works. So the person's question was the relationship between self-esteem and money. I think that this is a little bit of a confusing question because I'm not sure quite what they're asking. Probably it's wandering into the territory of, gee, you know, how would I feel more worthy somehow of spending money? And the answer is, I think of an important answer is, did you earn it? I think that's a very, very important question that is sitting underneath this person's letter. And so that doesn't mean you're a bad person for not having earned it. It just means that I would expect that your internal audience wouldn't consider that it would be a worthy process for you to be spending money and essentially expending resources in frivolous display or some kind of expensive display that you didn't earn, and therefore it wouldn't be wise in terms of long-term strategic planning to be doing that. And it might feel to a legitimate, highly conscientious brain that is just simply not a smart move. So I think that's actually the connection here that the person is feeling. And I think that pretty well sums up what this question was about.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lau, hold on one second. I'm going to cross off my to-do list, my daily affirmations, my positive affirmations, all these things. It takes me about 2.5 hours a day. That'll actually free up enough time to actually go out and accomplish something. So might have the intended desired effect.
There you go. Got it.
Now, Dr. Lyle, I have a little question here about this. Now, I'm not suggesting that this is going to be true for males and females, but question is, would it be normal for a woman to feel like she's earned a mate who takes care of her, provides for her, you know, allows her to spend whatever money that they make because that's what they're bringing to the table in addition to looks, brains, personality. But can she feel that she's earned it because she works hard at her appearance and to, you know, cultivate conversational skills and charm and all those other things? Is it common to feel for a woman to feel that she's earned it? And then conversely too, for men, can they feel like they've earned, you know, the mate that they're happy with because they work hard, they've climbed the dominance hierarchy, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so absolutely. So we're seeing inside here, we're seeing through the lens of personality. So my guess would be the female who is the trophy wife who is going to, you know, expend on conspicuous consumption at a level that she could have never done herself, I'm going to expect that there's going to be some personality characteristics that are going to probably be highly correlated with that behavior. So one of them is going to be lower in conscientiousness. Probably also openness. In other words, a desire for, novelty, possibly disagreeable would be associated with that, and probably lower intelligence. Okay. Such an individual is a walking lucrative market niche. Okay. This is exactly who we want to sell shiny shit to and useless crap and worthless seminars. This is perfect. Okay. Entitled, low conscientious, not very smart, and open. But if she's gorgeous and the guy makes enough money and he's willing to pay and be over rewarded in the looks department, hey, we wish them all well. All right.
Fantastic. All right. Our next question, Dr. Lyle. If women in one's social circles, acquaintances, friends, etc., seem receptive to casual mating, should one go for it without much worry? Or is it bound to lead to future problems with them in the group, as they may expect commitment on some level, even if they claim that they don't, and they therefore will get upset if they get none?
I this is a really great question. And this always reminds me of how different my life is from other people. So when Alan Goldhammer and I get asked questions like, well, what do you do when people invite you over for dinner? It's like, nobody's ever invited me over for dinner. How the hell would I know? Like, this just is not a problem with me and my diet. You know, this is so I live a very different life than most of these Homo sapiens. So this is i.e. the group. Like, what is this group? Who are they? Like, are these people all – this is this 15 or 18 people that represent the coalition, and there's like 10, 8 or 10 boys and 8 or 10 girls, and, what do they have? Some religious affiliation with each other, and, they're like a coalition, and therefore if you casual mate with one of them and then she's pissed off, it's like wrecks your reputation with the whole group. Like, I don't know. Maybe people live like this. I don't. Something could approximate this in a work setting, possibly, where there's a lot of coworkers that spend time together, and there's a loose coalition of some kind there. It's also possible in a fraternity. It could be in grad school, a little closed system of 15, 20 people, this sort of thing going on. So I could see how that could arise, that dynamic could arise. To some degree, the question would, I suppose, if one were in that situation and one, quote, took advantage in some fashion of some female who is receptive and then dumped her unceremoniously and then she was all pissed off about it, then that could potentially hurt your reputation in that group. Like, who the hell cares? Okay, so there is no group in my life that I would care about. if they gave me any, then they can all go pound sound down a rat hole, because I couldn't care less. So the question is, for me, would be, how deceptive was I to the female? And so as is common for me, there's of course many casual mating options. So, all right, let's just suppose that there was a casual mating strategy option and the female was signaling that she was casual mating strategy receptive, et cetera. Now, what would I think about this? I would feel completely and utterly justified in pursuing a casual mating strategy relationship. However, I would certainly be aware that there's an underhanded deal that often goes on in these dynamics. And that is often the case that the female thinks that she is open to casual mating strategy, but really isn't. Okay, so she actually has designs. Now, I've never had a situation where someone was trying to, openly advertise to me that they were open to casual mating, but period. Okay, so all of my history has been within the context of clear pair bond signaling. From the jump. However, you can see the obvious corollary, the mirror image of the male strategy pretending he is headed to pair bond strategy but is really headed to casual mating. The corollary is the female who pretends that she's open to casual mating but is really headed to pair bond. Okay? That's called snagging a guy. Okay? That's what that is. And so this is certainly the in fact, David Buss in his research in The Evolution of Desire very clearly found evidence that there's females that will play, you know, a dumb blonde strategy, like, hey, listen, you can kind of take an advantage of me sexually, and, you know, gee, like, I'm just kind of ditzy and I kind of don't know what's going on, when really that's a tar pit. So I certainly have seen that on a number of occasions, seeing guys get stuck in tar pits from exactly that strategy. So yeah, I wouldn't be worried about what the group thinks. I would be worried about whether or not, you know, who it is that you are, and if you have sufficient disagreeability enough to remove yourself from a tar pit if you happen to stick your foot in one. So that's how I look at that. I have a friend of mine, a really nice guy in grad school, and he absolutely had a tar pit walk up and bump into him and stick. He wound up, you know, unhappily in a relationship and then unhappily married. I have not checked to see whether or not they had children, but I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, that was a five went up to an eight, i.e. he was an eight, she was a five, and she made damn sure that she was super easily available and then stuck to him like tar. And he is a dead dinosaur right out of his happiness is in the bottom of the La Brea tar pit. All right. There you go.
Beware. Buyer beware. Right?
Buyer beware. Exactly. There you go.
All right. Dr. Lyle, there are many popular videos where reporters approach ignorant people on the street and make them say dumb things. One example that I've heard was, have you heard that some fictional country is leaving the European Union? And one person responded, sure, and then started answering a series of questions, unflinching about where they read the news, etc. While most people laugh, I get scared, even having embraced the view that all communication is manipulation. If I didn't know better, I would never in a thousand years assume that these people were lying. It's so foreign from the way I think, and it's not a unique example. Many times I vaguely thought that I knew some simple fact, only to be contradicted. So I accepted that the other person knew better. Why would they contradict me otherwise? But they were often wrong. Can you help me make sense of this madness?
Well, it's really not madness. When you see that kind of thing, they're cherry picking from a whole bunch of interviews that they did. And so they're finding the ones that are particularly entertaining. And it's super entertaining to watch low conscientious people at work.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And so, you know, what could be more fun than watching like a low conscientious salesman just like lying like crazy and just changing his story? It's inherently fascinating. Because of exactly what the person is commenting on, which is it's like, wow, I can't believe that other people would play the game so differently than I would play the game, and therefore I'm susceptible to this because my egocentric bias would misread these probabilities by a lot, and therefore this is worth knowing. So that's why there's a little bolt of fear in our listener, who's clearly high conscientious and maybe quite agreeable. So when someone contradicts him or her, the first thought is not, hey, well, you're wrong. Okay. So that's usually my first answer. Anybody contradicts me, I contradict them back. Okay. Got enough disagreeability in there. But our listener may be higher agreeable and high conscientious. And so as a result, they're finding out, or you get these experiences and you see that people that are lower and conscientious can can parade like they know things and they absolutely don't know them. And so anyway, so that's all that's going on here. There's no madness. All that there is that if you don't know something, and somebody asks you in a situation like that, bluffing is a pretty good strategy. And so a lot of people bluff like they know. And you know, for a great deal of the dynamics that would go on in human beings that would mean anything, i.e. mating dynamics, if some woman says, well, do you know where, you know, Kamchatka is? Sure. Yeah, have you ever been there? you could see how that would be a perfectly reasonable strategy to bluff for a while and not get caught like you didn't know. And so this is all part of esteemed gamesmanship in the display of intelligence and IQ. All right.
I have a very good friend who he and I were sharing stories of low conscientious people, and like you said, it was incredibly entertaining. How he had a partner in business who just was a salesman and would, come up with all kinds of stories just to get the sale. And then my friend had to cover for him and agree that, yeah, exactly. Half the warehouse burned down and that's why we could sell you this product.
Oh, man. There you go. All right,
Dr. Lyle. Dear Dr. Lyle, I'm pretty introverted and socialize very little. But I never fail to be baffled by how quickly distance kills relationships. I knew two girls who were best friends now the better part of a decade, but they completely stopped talking months after they were no longer in the same city. Mm-hmm. Also, I've heard that almost half of my college roommates don't even text goodbye when they're moving out, which honestly to me seems utilitarian to the point of sociopathy. Am I the oddball for feeling that when you've known someone for a long time, that means something? Is it because I'm low in openness and introverted?
No, it means you're high in conscientiousness. And so what we're seeing here is that we back up and we try to understand why humans do what they do. And the reason why humans do what they do is cost-benefit analysis. And so a big part of the cost is, and a big part of the benefit has to do with proxemics. And so you're probably going to buy gasoline where it's most convenient for you. And you're going to go to restaurants that are most convenient for you. You're going to do grocery store shopping. So I shop at a grocery store that's more expensive than the other store, without even figuring my time. Even when I was, when I didn't make as much money, it's still like too much trouble to go over to the cheaper grocery store. I just wasn't going to do it. So this is cost benefit. And so when people move away, the cost benefit, dramatically changes. The whole equation changes. And so a great deal of those benefits took place in proximity, and the costs were reduced by proximity. So it doesn't surprise us at all that proxemics dominate relationships. Now, obviously, that isn't always going to be the case. So it depends upon the nature of the relationship, how unusual the person's value proposition is. So if they've got a very unusual value proposition and they have something that they can continue to contribute to your life, then the distance isn't going to mean anything. And so it's all about the CB that explains the situation that you're observing. So a lot of friends, there's really nothing particularly unique about either of those people. And they have a relationship that's been based on mutual interests that would be normal for human beings to have when they're in close proximity. And if they were reasonably stable, reasonably agreeable people, they got along quite well. They might have been good friends for 10 years. However, when the dynamics change, the CB changes, it's over. I have a friend of mine, really, really nice guy, a psychiatrist that I used to work with. And I thought when I quit, I was a psychologist in the state prison system for 10 years. And I thought when I quit, this is a guy that super pleasant guy, bright, pleasant, you know, we like to play golf together. And this was a, you know, a really friendly, warm situation. And I believed when I was leaving that he and I would probably continue to play golf together, you know, several times a year. We have not contacted each other once in 5 years since I quit the prison. And it's not because I don't like him. If I saw him today, I'd have the same reaction that I have. It's just the CB. So the CB changes. And now it'd be a hassle. I'd have to drive over there. We'd have to meet. We have to set it up. We used to just say, hey, you feel like playing today? And we had our clubs in our trunks of our car. And if we felt like it, we'd be going, hey, why not? And so the cost of making the decision to do so was minimal. And this would be typical of friendships in close proximity. Now it would be a big song and dance, and we'd have to get it organized and get on our calendars and really intend to do this, you know, a week or two in advance. Eh, too much trouble. And like I said, and however, when Alan Goldhammer was in Australia, when we were young people and when we were young men, and I was doing my education in Virginia, we kept in contact on a weekly basis by sending tapes, audio tapes, back and forth for a year. And so, you know, that was a fair amount of hassle, speaking into a tape recorder and then listening to him, et cetera, and then mailing it off. Yeah, way more hassle with that than it would be to deal with my golf friend. But the CB was different. So we were young professionals headed towards trying to do something very interesting and learning fast in life. And so it was super worth it to keep in contact. So anyway, yeah, there's nothing sociopathic about this. This is just human beings running cost-benefit analysis. There's an interesting other little thread that I pick up in this individual. And that is that if you're high conscientiousness, which I think that this person is, then what's going to happen is very often, particularly if you're agreeable, which they probably also are from the sound of it, if you're high conscientious and agreeable, you are extremely likely to overinvest in relationships. In other words, let me explain what I mean by overinvestment. The friendships are fundamentally insurance policies. That's how they emerged in our natural history. And so the average person will extend the average amount of insurance to the average value proposition personality and body on the other side of the equation. So you run a cost-benefit analysis on what the person can do for you. You run a cost-benefit analysis on what you could do for them. And the two of you run this system, run a CB analysis against the market competitors, and you decide whether or not you're going to be friends. That's what it is. And so a big part of it is, what could you do for me if I was in XYZ kind of trouble? And what could I do for you? And so people that are friends, they don't know that they're doing this, but their mind is doing this. It's running exactly this kind of this style of computations. And so it turns out that whenever you're at the tail end of a bell curve, you've got a distorted view of what the typical person is thinking. So if you're super open, you're really frustrated with other people. You can't understand, you know, why don't you want to smoke mushrooms or whatever the hell it is? Okay. So I've got a friend of mine, a lovely lady in Asheville, North Carolina, very bright, open, pretty. She came to some seminar, introduced herself. And then she's talking to me about mushrooms. It's like, or whatever the hell it is, some hallucinogen. I'm like, no way, zero chance. Okay. You're talking to somebody that's probably at the 25th or 30th percentile for openness. There's zero chance. Whereas she's 95th percentile open. That's how she lives her life. And that's who she is. And so, you know, she's startled at how, like, what a clam I am. Like, there's no way I would ever consider anything like that. And she would never consider not doing that, knowing that it exists on the planet. Those are big differences in personality. And so when you are an outlier
you misread what the other people are doing. Very bright people can't believe how feeble-minded and error-prone are average people. And they'll sometimes infer that they're intending to be stupid and disruptive and, you know, create obstacles and inefficiency where none should exist. And the truth is, no, you're just not understanding. That's what a 100 IQ person can do. And when you are an outlier on any dimension, if you're real low in conscientiousness, you just can't understand why anybody makes such a big fuss about getting the rent in on time. It just doesn't make any sense. And so in the same way, if you're high conscientious and you are reasonably agreeable, you will overestimate how much insurance is out there in your friendship. You will believe that they are as invested as you are, but you are in fact overinvesting in most cases. And so this is where you'll find out that you would have come through big for somebody, but it turns out that when the shoe's on the other foot, and you would expect them to come in for you when you need some help, and they're nowhere to be found. And it's like, there you go. This would be the typical experience of a high conscientious, agreeable human is going to be like scratching their head and feeling very surprised and hurt at the betrayal as the rats jump off a sinking ship at the first sign of trouble when they needed to file an insurance claim in the friendship. So this individual, I would sort of warn you to not put yourself in a position where you are allowing some friend who's lower in conscientiousness and more disagreeable to put you in a position where you're extending yourself substantially for that individual. Watch out, because the very things that you're seeing that are surprising you in normal human beings and how they may, how their CB dynamics change with respect to friendship and its investment process, you are seeing that you are in fact an outlier, just as you're commenting. And that should be a warning device to you. Don't get yourself in a position of high credit with respect to some friendship debtor that has, unless there's awfully good reason for you to believe that they are a good reciprocator and that they see this friendship in the same way that you do.
Fascinating. And all right, Dr. Lyle, I think we got time for one more that wasn't on our list, but what do you think? Time for this one more?
Sure. We'll cap it off.
All right. This has to do with Tinder. So, and experience of males versus females. So I thought it'd be fun to talk. So, dear Dr. Lyle, I'm a straight, relatively attractive, somewhat well put together 21-year-old man. My luck on Tinder is pretty much exactly the same as most guys under the 80th percentile.
Stop.
What's that? Yeah.
Not a man. 21-year-old kid. Okay, well, go ahead. go ahead.
So, Dr. Lyle, I get 4 or 5 matches per day. Most girls don't respond, but I get a couple of dates per month. Out of curiosity, I let my profile be seen by both men and women. I was shocked to find that I got literally hundreds of matches on the first day. I assumed it was because I was new on the scene, but it continued for weeks, and every day I got more than 50 matches from men. Is there any evolutionary reason why I would get so many more matches with men than with women?
Let me get this straight. I just you know Tinder, and I don't know the app. Okay. So let me get this straight. So if you make yourself available to both men and women, and does that mean that the men would assume that you are gay or bi?
That's right.
Okay, got it. Okay, so the question is why he's getting so many more hits from men than he is from women. Answer, men are casual mating strategy animals. Okay, so there's a very good evolutionary reason for this. So you would, I think there's more to it, like the swiping and that the men just swipe everything hoping to get a match. So that's another issue. That's a substantial component of this fiasco, but from a broader perspective, what we're also seeing is that men's interest in casual mating is going to be much greater than women's generally, and the bar is going to be a lot lower. Remember the evolutionary dynamics of casual mating. So the evolutionary dynamics are that for males, males are going to be the low investment member of the species, and the female is the high investment member of the species. So if a female is going to engage in casual mating, then she's going to want to make sure that if she's not going to get resources from the male to support an incipient child, then what she's going to do is she's going to make damn sure she gets really fancy genes. So she is planning to sleep up, okay? So if she's an 8, she's looking at 10s. If she's a 6, she's looking at 8s. In other words, she could be looking at 10s, quite frankly. So the truth of the matter is the female is willingness to engage in casual mating behind what I call weak knees delta, or the perceived delta or difference between the sexiness gene quality of the pair. And so the female is absolutely not interested in sleeping down for casual mating. No way. Okay. She intuitively knows that she brings more to the table. She intuitively understands that her sexuality is far more valuable than his sexuality because, you know, well, she just knows this. I mean, it's in her DNA to know this. She is an egg-guarding, sex-guarding machine. That's what she is. The male's job is to try to charm his way past the defenses. And so one way to get past the defenses, if you're a male, is to be willing to sleep down. So if you're an 8, you attack a 6, and the 6 may feel weak in the knees, weak knees delta, and you get laid, okay? So the male does not have the problem sleeping down at all. The male would also love to sleep up. That's fine too. The male's like, hey, anything goes. Casual mating, you know, obviously they have their limits. But if you're an 80th-ish percentile male and you're gay or advertising that you would be gay, you should be getting hit on from all sides. In other words, you're acceptable to everybody. You're acceptable to the 10s because remember the 10, all of the people in the mating pool in the gay community being males, they essentially are casual mating dominant by psychology. And so it's essentially a group that has no female in there that is withholding. So you would expect it to be a very vigorous free-for-all, which is exactly what it is that we're seeing in this person's experience. Okay. So, you know, it's being accentuated by the swipe issue. So the males in general are just going to swipe everything and then just see what comes back. That's the right advertising strategy. Whereas females aren't going to do that. They're going to very deliberately only swipe the ones that they like. So that's contributing to what this person's experiencing. But the underlying, you know, that also is sort of derivative of the differences between males and females in terms of the very same evolutionary dynamic, which is casual mating dominant for the male, pair bond dominant for the female. And that dynamic is running exactly what this person is saying. In the Kinsey report of 1981, I believe, is where they carefully, you know, there's been better data since. So we're almost 40 years ago. So I'm showing my age. But in that, I think it was in 1981. Well, I know what Tinder is. So that's pretty good. But in that report, it was, I think, the first time where we had good data on the gay community. And it was the first data that we ever saw that was really numerical and meant anything. It was intelligently collected by legitimate social scientists. And I believe that about 25% of the people polled in the Kinsey report, males, gay males, had over 500 partners. Okay.
Wow.
That tells the story. That's telling you that looks like what a heterosexual male would do if they didn't have constraints on the other side of the trade. Okay, so that's the dynamic that this person is seeing in the extraordinary difference that he's getting in terms of feedback from males and females.
No eggs to defend.
No eggs to defend. You got it.
Fascinating. All right, Dr.
All right.
Lyle. Thank you very much for the wonderful information, as always. Dr. Lyle, we will look forward to talking with you next week.
Very good. Oh, we should also put in a word for anybody who listens this long. The fabulous Dr. Jen Hawk is on her way soon.
Yes.
We'll let people know. We're getting her organized and getting her set up and cornering her with commitments. And so she's going to be a wonderful addition to the show. I think people are really going to enjoy listening to her.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it as well. So it's going to be a lot of fun, everyone. So stay tuned and we'll let you know when it all happens.
Very good.
Fascinating, Dr. Lyle. All right. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Good deal.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.